بسم الله والحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله. So, we were in the last few weeks just breaking down the first chapter of the Quran, Surah Fatiha, in deep detail, the meaning of it, because we were looking essentially at a concept. Oh, that's still written here. Great that they clean this board. Called khushu', which, you know, you can talk about in terms of humility, concentration, focus. But the idea is that within our prayer, the ritual in and of itself is not necessarily seen as an end, but it's a means to something. And embedded within it are both outward aspects and inward aspects. So for a lot of us, especially when you're exploring Islam, you're a convert to Islam, if you're coming back to just learning Islam again, we're given the black and white and the do's and don'ts, but not necessarily those inward parts to it, right? So you can learn how to pray with your body, but in Islam, you're also learning how to pray with your heart, right? There's that inward kind of component to it. And one of the inward elements or values is this thing of khushu', which is focus, concentration. This is why we went and did a deep dive of that first chapter, because in the Hanafi school, which is the legal school that we've been looking at, the recitation of the first chapter, Fatiha, in every cycle of prayer is considered a necessary, a wajib act. And today we're going to review some of the stuff that we talked about last semester, but in the context of prayer. But if you all can continue to engage the meaning, not just the translation, but the meaning, right? And there's a nuanced difference there, because you can translate words and then you're just playing them in your head, but it doesn't mean that you're extrapolating meaning from it. If you miss those classes, they're all recorded. You can go on our YouTube channel. They're on our podcasts, where we break down what these words mean, the nuance of them, not using antiquated language, just so you can actually connect at a deeper level as you're reciting it, right? The logic being, if I was speaking to you all in a language right now, then nobody in the room knows how to speak, right? I don't know what that language would be. What's like a random language that probably no one in the room knows how to speak?
Chinese?
Huh? Chinese? Does anybody know how to speak Chinese in the room? Right. Devehi. Do people know the language Devehi? Right? Speaking. I can't speak English. It's spoken in the Maldives, right? Probably most of us don't speak it. If I was speaking to you in Devehi, after a few minutes, you just wouldn't be able to pay attention. Not for any other reason other than I'm not communicating in a language that there's comprehension in. And so the ability to maintain focus when someone is just throwing random syllables of sounds is very reasonable to say it's hard to pay attention to it. Do you see what I mean? Right, so you want to engage the meaning of it and build a relationship with the meaning of it as best as you can. And simultaneously, you're memorizing it to start reciting it. Right, and we'll review some of these things today, but in the obligatory acts of the prayer in the Hanafi school, why you don't have to like pray in a different language. You can pray in Arabic, even if you don't know Arabic. In the Hanafi school, all you have to be able to recite is a single verse of the Quran in your prayer. It can be any part of the Quran as an obligation, right? So the shortest verse of the Quran says, "Thumma nadhir." So if you just say that, you fulfill the obligation. It doesn't mean that that's what you're going to do forever, but as you're learning outside of the prayer, you're going to add elements to it, which is what we're doing in this class over the summer. How's it been going for those of you who have been trying to memorize the first chapter? Yeah. Where are things at right now? How's that been as a process? Has anybody done any of it? Yeah. What's that been like? Is it hard? Is it not hard?
Dynamic of prayer changes. You really want to take your time and and you no longer want to rush the thought to really understand the meaning.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. When you memorize something, you can just start spitting it out, do you know? Like, think about things you've memorized in your life. Do you know what I mean? Right now, probably if we threw on something that you listened to as a child, all the words would just kind of flow back, right? Or when you were in high school, or maybe some of you are in high school, or, you know, when you were a little younger, there's something that you just heard constantly that was something you knew the words to, like, every lyric in it. It just comes out instantaneously. It sticks with you, right? And this is a challenge with something that has capacity to be memorized rotely. You can get to a place where you can just spit it out very, very easily. Do you know? If you ever sit down with people who were of your age demographic and they can recite to you, like, the theme songs of every TV show that they ever watched from when they were little kids, and they could do it at a super fast speed, it's because you're just kind of engrossed and embedded, right? You don't want to treat your prayer in that way. Do you know what I mean? But as the words become memorized and they're just there very kind of concretely, rotely, it has that capacity. So pondering, reflecting, contemplating, and taking it at a pace that's reasonable just adds to the ability to kind of draw meaning from it, right? Anything else coming up for people? Or any questions on any of the stuff we've done so far? How's everybody doing?
Great.
Yeah? Sounds great. Yeah. Okay. So there's going to be a couple of things that we're going to do today. And a little bit of it's going to be review. So we've gone through, like, the first chapter, Fatiha. You want to give yourself a deadline that within the next 2 weeks, that's 14 days, that you should try to memorize that and also be in a place where you're spending a little time with it every day, reflecting on its meaning, you know? So you're taking something from it, just engaging it. And there are not so many words to it. So every day, if you're just engaging a couple of words, you'll be able to add on to it slowly. And 14 days is actually a long time. And why we want to do that is because one of the next things we want to jump into is learning some of the other shorter chapters. Hey, guys. So that you can fulfill the rest of that first unit of prayer, which requires reciting a long verse or a few short verses. And we'll look at a couple of other shorter chapters. Today, what we want to get into now is kind of breaking down some of what becomes the different aspects of the prayer. And some of you were here when we did this, but just to review, everything that goes into an action within Islam as religion can be broken into a few different categories, right? They're all placed into boxes that are categorized in kind of a legalistic frame. And that spectrum is something that we'll look at the words in Arabic and in English. So on this end, you have what's called fard, which is obligatory. These are acts that are required. They have to be done, right? And the basis of these are text and meaning that are definitive. Does that make sense? So we have five daily prayers in Islam because there's text as well as the meaning of text that is definitive in the performance of those five prayers. So somebody says, why do Muslims pray five times a day? Why do they fast in the month of Ramadan? Why are they required to perform the pilgrimage if they have the means to do so? Why do they give a mandatory charity? There is a text corresponding that its meaning is concrete, definitive, and the text is also a definitive text. Does that make sense? On the other end of the spectrum, you have what's called haram.
And this is strictly prohibited. This also has a similar base to it. For something to be strictly prohibited, impermissible, it has to have a clear text as well as clear meaning to the text. So, don't eat pork just means don't eat pork. That's what it means. What we get as we come closer, in the middle, you have what's called mubah, and this just means neutral. These are things that are just kind of allowed, right? So, you know, the color of this chair, just like, just whatever, right? It's neutral. Then you have to the left of that, what is called mustahab. This is recommended. And this has a break in it that also has a word that's called sunnah mu'akkada. And this is a prophetic practice. When you start to get into this realm, you have either text or meaning that can be probabilistic. It's not as concrete. Does that make sense? And its corresponding category on this side is called makruh, which means disliked. And the similar idea that either in text or meaning, something is probabilistic. Why would you have these things? And what they do in the Hanafi school is they add in the category of wajib, which has that base, that it's a lesser degree of obligation. So they'll call this necessary, which is what the recitation of Fatiha is in the prayer. It's not seen as an obligation, but a necessary act. Because the idea is that you don't want to make a claim that something is absolutely obligatory or absolutely prohibited unless you're really sure that it is. Does that make sense? And so on this spectrum, what ends up happening theoretically is that everything to this side of the spectrum can, at some point or another, fit into a box of permissibility, what we call halal, even if it's something that's disliked, so long as you're not doing it consistently or with regularity, because it doesn't fit into the box of strict prohibition. And the category of disliked can be broken into branches too, but we don't have to get into it in too much detail. But everything is going to fit into one of these boxes in terms of acts that you undertake. They're going to fit into one of these categories. You don't have to learn the Arabic, but people are going to throw the Arabic at you. And you're going to, unfortunately, which I'm really sorry for, have a lot of people that don't know what the words mean, and they're going to tell you something is something that it's not. This word, haram, a lot of Muslims like to use it all the time, right? And they're going to make you feel like you're a really bad person because everything just turns into a desire to be on the edge of the spectrum, black and white, just definitive, right, wrong. But there's so much more than that that exists categorically. Does that make sense? And when people don't know, like, the technical definitions or the basis of things, it doesn't mean that they're still not going to tell you something. And one of the things you want to know is that there's a lot of different opinions that exist in different ways. So we're looking at prayer through one methodology that's called the Hanafi school of thought. There's other schools, and people will do certain things differently. And you just want to see it as kind of a mode of existence that respects differences of opinion, and to not get into a place where religion starts to get weaponized in a way that really removes God from the equation. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? Does it? Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I find, like, I sort of struggle with this range a bit, in the sense of, I respect it, but then when I'm online and I'm, like, trying to look up singular, you know, views on, like, dogs, for example, like, so many scholars of different schools say things, music, or, like, all these different little things have, like, comment sections on Instagram, people are just going back and forth in different ways, and it's kind of hard.
It's crazy hard.
Yeah, to, like, yeah. You know, when you're just kind of getting into it, not, you know, trying to choose, like...
I would say don't do it that way, right? And it's hard, but what you have as a challenge is not, like, inaccessible information. Your challenge is the other extreme. You have oversaturated access to information, but there's not a way to distill information. Do you know? There's all kinds of people that write everything online. Do you know what I mean? I tell my kids this now because my son is 7 and my daughter's 10, and they don't inherit technology that, like, people inherited when I was younger and kind of went through a process as technology develops, or some of you inherit it at even a younger age. But my kids are younger than all of you. And sitting down and explaining to my son or my daughter that everybody on the internet doesn't tell the truth, you know? And helping them to understand fundamentally that that's a concept, or that everything that's written doesn't necessarily take you into consideration. Do you know what I mean? And there's a disconnect from the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the way he engaged his companions. There are literal people who come, for example, right? A man comes to the Prophet and says, "O Messenger of God, can I kiss my wife while I'm fasting?" And the Prophet answers the question and says, "Yes." And another person comes shortly thereafter and says, "Can I kiss my wife while I'm fasting?" And to him, he says, "No." It's the same exact question. It's given a different answer. And one of the companions is left in a place of, you know, why does this question have different answers? Right? And so the Prophet contextualizes and says, to the person he said no to, this was a younger person who was recently married. And he, you know, at a younger age, him and his wife, the kiss might lead to something that gets continuity. Because in our fast, there's the fast is broken if you have, like, a deeply physical, intimate relationship. If you have sex with someone, you're not allowed to do that when you're fasting. So the worry is the kiss will lead to something else. So to him, he says no. And to the older person, he's a little bit more in control, right? He's like an old man. It's not going to go anywhere beyond that. So to him, he says yes, right? You can't fundamentally have a Q&A site online that answers every question for you about Islam's relevancy to you. It just doesn't work that way. And anybody who tells you otherwise, they're wrong. There's people who put in their best effort, and you're trying your best. But it's going to have a gap for the reason that you're outlining, because some of these things have to be a little bit more contextualized with specificity, right? And in the journeys that many of you are on, whether you're coming back to this, you know, at a point you were born into it, you converted at some point in your life, you're exploring the religion for yourself, you want to do it in a way that's systematic. Do you know what I mean? So why we're talking about prayer is because prayer is, like, a very important integral, you know? So learn about your prayer, right? And adopt the Quranic counsel that says, like, when you don't know something, that just go and ask somebody who knows, you know? And I'm happy to talk to you about anything you want. If I don't know, like, an answer, I have a ton of people I could refer you to. But this is where the internet becomes actually really sticky,
because it gives you a lot of information without context. And it also isn't necessarily always stuff that was written with you in mind. Do you get what I'm saying? Does that make sense? And one of the most important things that comes out of what you're saying, it's okay to say that it's really hard. Like, it's really tough to navigate all of this. It's not an easy thing to decipher, because when you literally have a computer in your pocket and you can look up anything and all of these things are going to come and spit information back at you, it becomes hard to say, how do I know which one is what makes sense? Does that make sense? One of the things that you want to understand is that haram is always necessarily haram. Do you get what I mean? Meaning that just because something is permissible doesn't mean you have to do it, right? You're allowed to eat chicken. Doesn't mean you have to do it, but you can't eat pork. Do you understand? There's a difference in the sense that the two don't balance each other out, right? The way that you can engage them. Permissibility doesn't equate to normativity. So just because it can be done a certain way doesn't mean that's the only way for it to be done. The default is that in pretty much all acts that are mundane, everything is permissible unless somebody can tell you there's a reason that it's impermissible. The onus is on someone to be able to explain to you, why is music not X, Y, or Z? Why is a dog X, Y, or Z? And there's a plethora of opinions on this, right? And nobody can deny that. There is. On the other end of it, not in mundane acts, but in devotional acts, the default is that it is considered impermissible unless there's a reason that one can prove that it's permissible, right? So why we pray in Islam the way we pray, these five daily prayers, is based off of evidences, not just I think, I feel. Do you get what I mean? And the ratio between in the mundane, what is permissible and impermissible, is like 1,000 to 1. So for every one thing that you can't do, you can't eat pork, but you can eat like everything else. Do you know? You can't drink wine, but you can drink like millions of different juices. Do you know what I mean? And that's literally like the way the ratio kind of functions itself. Do you know? But principally, this and this has like bases to it. What you want to do is just try your best, right? And when we talked about this, you know, my Monday night halakha that some of you come to, this is where the idea is, like, you talk to people of knowledge. It's not always like religious scholars, right? Like, I wasn't feeling so well last week. I appreciate some of you reached out. I think at this class last week, I was breathing really heavily. And then that night, I actually like couldn't breathe at all when I was sleeping. So on Thursday, I ended up going to the doctor and they sent me to the hospital ER where I sat for a bit. I'm doing well now. But when I was like trying to figure out what was wrong with me, everybody had an answer for what was wrong with me, you know? I was talking to someone, they were like, you know, you sound like you're out of breath. And I was like, yeah, I'm having strained breathing. They're like, oh, it's probably your allergies, right? Or maybe you ate something. And I said, how do you know? Like, I wasn't trying to be rude, but I was like, what? Like, how do you know, right? You're not a doctor. You know what I mean? And for me, you know, a couple of weeks ago, a good friend of mine who was a little older than me, he passed away. We buried him in California. There were a lot of different things kind of like floating in my head. So the doctor at the urgent care was like, go to the ER. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to go to the ER. Why would I not? And I'm going to go ask the doctors who are trained. And that's what the verse means, right? Ask people who know. It doesn't just mean ask the religious scholar. In Islam, interdisciplinary modes of engagement are also really important in being able to create like legal rulings. Do you know? So if somebody is going to talk to you about mental wellness, for example, they need to not just be somebody who knows like ritual and theology, but also has a background in mental health. If somebody is going to talk to you about any discipline or any area of expertise, you would engage people across like areas of expertise. Do you know what I mean? Do other people have this issue when they're navigating stuff online? Yes. So what do you do?
Close the app.
Yeah.
Close the app? Oh, well, great. What app is it that you're closing?
Instagram.
Instagram. Yeah. Don't look. Your hearts are precious, regardless of where your religious journeys take you. You don't want to engage your celestial self through soundbite information. Do you know? And you're just going at a pace that makes sense. So when there's so much information you can absorb, it doesn't mean that all of it is at the time that you need to absorb it, right? There's a structure to learning also. And learn the things that are more integral and kind of just go at a pace that makes sense and talk to people, right? Ask people what it is that's there. Somebody had their hand raised. You had your hand raised?
I was just going to say, like, when I look something online, I usually go, like, to different imams or, like, mosques and ask about it just to confirm if it's right or wrong. So it looks like one way just to confirm that what I looked up is right or wrong.
Yeah, and if you have somebody that you can ask those questions of, that's great. And that's the whole idea, right? Like, you talk to somebody who knows. And being able to understand, like, how might they relate to you coming from your culture, coming from, you know, your heritage, you're new to Islam, right? Somebody who's going to also be empathetic in their listening. You know, they know you enough. Because in that example that I gave, the Prophet knows where these people are coming from. He's not throwing just, like, random information at them. He knows and is seeing them as a whole individual. It's not like a drive-by, like, Q&A. Do you know what I mean? So you have to see yourself as somebody that's worth more than that. Do you know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So everything is going to fit into one of these boxes. Obligatory, necessary, recommended, neutral, disliked, strictly prohibited. And we are focusing right now in the prayer section on, like, necessary acts. Because to perform prayer in the Hanafi school, the obligatory acts, they're all pretty simple, right? It's just going through the postures, having a final sitting, and reciting just one short verse of the Quran, and that suffices. Do people pray that way? No, they don't, like, in general. But when there's a reason to, right? You're new to it, you're learning it, you're still fulfilling the obligation, and we're adding to it as we go along. Does anybody have any other questions on this? I know I went through it really fast, just because we did this a few months ago in more detail. But anything that doesn't make sense, it's also totally fine. We can go at a slower pace on it. Yeah.
I mean, like, one ayah, when you say it's only that you have to read, like in the prayer?
Yeah, we're going to talk about it all. But in the Hanafi school, in the fara'id, the obligatory acts of prayer, you only have to read, like, any short verse of the Quran. It doesn't have to be Fatiha. Yeah. So the shortest verse says, thumma nadir. If you just said that, that suffices. Yeah. So any questions on these boxes, these categories? The way that this builds itself up is not, like, in a very kind of homogeneous way. It doesn't work that way because you have very few obligations and very few prohibitions, and there's a lot in the middle that is gray because we're so diverse and different from each other, right? Can you imagine if each one of you in this room had to lose your sense of individualism and identity, right? To be Muslim is to not commit cultural apostasy of some kind, right? You become linked now to your own innate identities, and it influences the way kind of religion manifests, and custom and culture impacts the way kind of things are practiced, do you know? And so these are the words that we're going to be using as we kind of go through the elements of prayer and talk about them in a little bit more detail. So I know some of you were here when we talked about this some months ago, and feel free to chime in. So we're going to look first at the conditions of prayer. And the book that we had told people, if you have it, it's called Ascent to Felicity.
you don't have the book, you could also pull up a PDF online of it, where we'll go through it. And this section is on page 74, the conditions of prayer. In Arabic, the word for condition is called shurut. And these are things that exist outside of prayer, meaning these things need to happen and be in place in order for the prayer to be performed. So if they're not in place, then the prayer is not, like, met. You were going to say something?
I was going to say that shurut or shurut.
Shurut. Yeah, like a shart in, if you speak Urdu and Hindi, it's the same word. Ascent to felicity. Yeah. And you can take a minute if people want to pull it up. You find it online. But also, it's not a big deal. We're going to write these things up on the board. Yeah. So what this means is if you don't have these things at the onset of the prayer, the validity of the prayer is not met. Validity meaning, like, there's mechanics, there's prerequisites. The acceptance of something is between God and the person. But in order for one to deem it valid, the mechanics that are outlined, they have to be in place based off of the categories. So the obligatory ones, if those aren't there, it doesn't work. So this is not a inside of the prayer group that we're going to talk about. This is what's happening before you start to pray. Does that make sense? Yeah? So first condition is that you have to be in a state of ritual purity. And this means you're free from what's called minor or major impurity. So what does that mean? This is what we call, like, being in a state of wudu.
And we, like, talked about wudu for, I think, like, 5 weeks, you know, if people remember, right? Was anybody, any of you here for that? Some of you were here, right? Yeah, we talked about it for a while, right? So wudu is the way that you're washing up for prayer. So if somebody says, I'm going to pray, but I'm not making my wudu, and we're not going to go through the steps of it right now. I can do that with you all at some point, but I'm just going to outline what these conditions are. This is a necessary condition. Like, you have to have wudu in order to make your ritual prayer. Yeah.
I know you spoke about wudu. My only question about wudu is...
You can ask anything you want. Go ahead.
Oh,
yeah.
Does it have to follow that order?
No.
Oh.
Not in the Hanafi school. So in the Hanafi school, wudu is not seen as a devotional act. So intention is not necessary. The order is not. The verse that we looked at in the Quran for wudu, just a quick recap, it doesn't include the mouth or the nose. So what are recommended acts in wudu in the Hanafi school are the rinsing of the mouth, the nose, the number of times you will wash a body part, and the order of it. The other things are obligatory, right? So the washing of the face, the arms up to and including the elbows, the head. So the face constitutes from the top of the forehead to underneath your chin and earlobe to earlobe. It's the face. You're going to go up to your elbow, including it, so above it. And when you wash, water has to get on every part of the body. So you're, for example, if you fold your arm in, like, water can miss right here. So you'll open this up and wash in here, both arms, the head, you're wiping over the head, right, taken from it. So if you put water on your hands, you can take these three fingers and you're gonna rub them over your head. Then you take this finger, put it on the inner side of your ear, And then you take your thumb and you rub it on the outer part of your ear, right? Because it's all new water, you see? So, does that make sense? Yeah? And then your feet, you're going to put your, go through every, toe on your foot and wash up to your ankle on both feet. And that constitutes a valid wudu. Yeah. Yeah, you can just take a shower, and that counts. And in the Hanafi school, if you take a shower and you don't make the intention for wudu, you still have wudu, because intention is not a necessary act for wudu in the Hanafi school. Yeah.
So is that why when you make the yamum, it's only like four steps, really? Because those are like the only four that are like obligatory, or like that you have to do.
Yeah, because it's also just like more of a symbolic thing, right? Because you're taking the dirt and you're kind of going through it in a spiritual kind of way. Yeah, yeah.
So if you're taking like a shower and you didn't like what's water in your mouth or your nose, does that, do you have to go back and just...
No, because those are recommended parts to it. Right, and why do you want to know these things? Right, is because certain things are situational. And we talked about this a lot in detail. For example, in different schools of thought, what's the minimum you have to do of your head varies. In the Hanafi school, it's a fourth of your head. In some schools, you literally just have to do a portion of your hair, right? So you can be a woman who wears a headscarf and you're in the middle of a workplace that is not conducive to Islamic practice and you're all kind of scarfed up. And you don't want to like unravel and then ravel again, so you just can stick your hand underneath it. Do you get what I mean? But knowing the fiqh is helpful because it allows for you to be able to adapt in certain situations. Do you know? And that's why we want to take these things slowly and do a deep dive into them, so that there's not just about like learning Islam, but there's a philosophy to learning. And when you go online or you just talk to somebody who's Muslim, they might just throw the end result at you and not get you to a place that helps you know how to maneuver in situations. Does that make sense? Right? Yeah, go ahead.
I had someone told me that women should not wear acrylic nails because that invalidates their wudu.
As long as whatever you're wearing doesn't prevent water from getting to every part, right? So I'm wearing like a ring right now. I'd have to remove the ring, okay. You know? I got on some beads. I take off the beads because the water has to hit every part of the skin, right? So if somebody has a barrier of anything, right, that then prevents water from getting to something, then the wudu is not complete. But if it's something that's water permeable, then that's a different circumstance. Do you see? So the notion is to understand the principle. You can't have a barrier. Like my shirt, I can't wash over the shirt because it's creating a barrier, right? So that's the same idea conceptually. Does that make sense? Yeah. So in order for you to stand in prayer, you got to be in a state of wudu. So this is the first condition. Outside of the prayer, you need to be in this state of purity, ritual purity. Minor impurity, you used the restroom, you woke up from a long sleep, you weren't just dozing, you know, things like that, you pass wind. Major impurity, you're coming out of a menstrual cycle, if you have like a nocturnal emission, you know, some type of like sexual experience, that would then require doing what's called a ghusl, which is a shower that essentially incorporates the wudu as well as like a shower on top of that, that has like a process to it. That's condition number one. Any other questions on that? So condition number two, there can't be anything that is filthy on your clothes, body, or place of prayer. And so what constitutes filth? Like urine, alcohol, things like this. There's narrations in our tradition that say the entire world is a mosque, like a place of prayer. And there's narrations that also qualify this that say the entire world is a place of prayer, except like bathrooms and graveyards. Right? So, for example, it might make logical sense why someone couldn't pray where there's a toilet, right? In and of itself, there's a chance that there might be like urine somewhere on the ground or something to that effect. So you can pretty much pray any place, but in terms of location, you want to make sure that it's clean. The default understanding is that everything is clean unless there's a reason to believe that it's not clean. So you can walk through the streets of Manhattan and you can see Muslim people praying everywhere. There's Muslim people that pray on top of their taxi cabs. There's Muslim people that pray. No, they do, right? There's people that pray, you know, in the parks, on the sidewalks. There's people that pray, like, all over the place. And someone could say, oh, it's New York. It's gross, like this and that. But there's unless there's a reason that you know that it's not clean, the default is that things are clean. Does that make sense? So you could go. When you have a prayer mat, it's not seen as a sacred object in Islam, right? It's not a sanctified object. Essentially, what you're doing with the mat is you're just carrying something that you know is definitively clean. And you put it down, and then where you're going to be praying is like a clean place to pray. Does that make sense? So that place of prayer, your body has to also be clean of anything filthy, right? So you can't have things on your physical being and your clothing as well, right? And there's kind of parameters around this, but there are things that are taken seriously. So this is why at our tradition, you have like not just the utilization, for example, of toilet paper when you go to the bathroom, because it's not fully removing, but you use water as kind of a cleansing agent to be able to remove excrement fully from your body. Do you know? So condition number two, that there's nothing like dirty, impure on anything of your being or the place that you're going to be praying in as well. And you want to try your best, right? In some of these situations, and it can get tricky, especially for people who they're the only Muslim in their family. Their family doesn't know that they're Muslim, you know? And we want to think about this within reason. And this is another reason why you don't want to look up on the internet certain things or just kind of speak off the top of your head, because you're going to have to try your best in certain situations and circumstances. And for some people, when you're in a Manhattan apartment where everybody is on top of each other and you don't want your family to know that you're Muslim, like the only place you can go by default to pray and still be safe is going to be like in a bathroom. Do you know? Does that make sense? And so these definitive statements become really hard. Like, yeah, you shouldn't be praying in the bathroom. That's the default. But sometimes there's kind of context that people are listening to what you're saying. And just because they hear you say it, they're going to take it as, well, then I just maybe shouldn't pray at all. Do you get what I mean? Right? And it's like, no, man, like you got to talk to the person and really hear where they're at. Does that make sense? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not sort of referring to like filth, like if someone is poor and they can't afford to like have clean clothes. Or
if your clothes are dirty, like say I, you know, haven't washed my shirt in a week or something. That's not what it is. But if somebody got something that was considered ritually impure, say there was urine on my shirt, you know, like, or, you know, something similar, all you do is wash it off. I don't have to, like, throw away my shirt. It doesn't have to be laundered. The recommended, like, practice is to have water flow over that spot, like, at least, you know, a handful of times, 3 times to 7 times. If you do it once fully, like, that suffices also. But you just rinse it off. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense? Yeah. But it has nothing to do with, like, social class or socioeconomic background or anything like that. You know? Yeah.
You mentioned alcohol. What about alcohol and deos and perfumes? You know, what's your opinion on that?
It depends on what the source of the alcohol is, right? And if there's alcohol that's made of wine, of grapes, like fermented grapes and dates, those in the Hanafi school are categorically different from other types of alcohols and synthetic alcohols and these kinds of things. Yeah. If you come to Jummah on Friday, I don't know if you guys were at Jummah last Friday, but we were talking about like four hadith that are foundational hadith from a text that's called the Sunan of Abi Dawood, where it's got like tons of hadith in it, but the author says, if you know these four hadith from this book, like they suffice you for everything. And one of those says the halal is clear and the haram is clear and in between them are doubtful things that many people don't know about, right? And we'll talk about some of this more in that. If there's things of doubt, it's better to leave them. But if they're actually doubtful, you know? Okay. The third is you cover what is called your aura. This is the Arabic word, aura. But it's essentially like the parts of your body that you are required to have covered at a minimum in your prayer. For men, it is from your navel to below your knees. And for women, it's everything other than your face and your hands and your feet. And within that, like, you wouldn't have a man show up to pray with just like the lower part of their body covered, you know? Like, if I come to Jummah on Friday and all I got is a towel wrapped around my waist, I'm pretty sure somebody's gonna have a problem with it. Do you know what I mean? But we're talking about within the prayer, there are parts of the body that have to be covered, and you're getting yourself ready. The common thread through all of this is that you're building a presence prior to getting into prayer, right? The same way we're saying, you can read the first chapter differently if you know what it means, and you're gonna go through it a little bit more slow. So in each of these things, it's not like a checkbox that's meant to create anxiety. It's a checkbox that's meant to create consciousness, right? Did I wash up for the prayer? Are my clothes like clean? I'm going to go stand in front of God. Do you know? Like, what's the state that I'm standing in front of God in, right? Is everything kind of dressed the way that it needs to be dressed? And it's not to kind of anthropomorphize one's relationship with God. But think about how it is that you would look to dress in anticipation of any event or occasion that you know already has its own criteria for expectation of a dress code. You walk into a gala, they're going to expect you to be wearing something. It's a wedding day. You're going to be expected to wear something. You're going to go to a funeral. You're not going to show up to a funeral in a tank top and a pair of pink shorts, right? It's going to be disrespectful to the event. Do you know what I mean? And if you try to do something that just doesn't make sense out of deference to the occasion, somebody is going to say to you, why are you dressed like that? Do you know? Like, do you know what you're going to do? Right? So similarly, the idea is as we're going through these five or six conditions, they're meant to create consciousness. Regardless of how it is that you choose to dress outside of your prayer, you want to be on top of this within the course of your prayer. At a minimum, what happens is if more than a quarter of a limb that is meant to be covered in the course of a prayer becomes uncovered, then the prayer itself doesn't have validity. Does that make sense? Which also goes on the other end. You don't want to be the haram police that somebody's standing in prayer and you're like pulling on their clothes and measuring this and that, right? Now, if you have multiple things that are supposed to be covered that are not like beyond a quarter, but the sum total of them exceeds now a quarter of what is the minimal like sized limb of covering, then that also becomes a problem. Does that make sense? So, you know, just be ready to pray when you gotta pray. And if you gotta carry clothes with you, then carry some clothes with you that cover yourself up. You know? Yeah.
So just to be
everything from right here to a little bit below the knee needs to be covered.
The minimum for a man is from below the navel to below the knee.
In my arms. Right?
Yeah, but you should be covered, like, with a shirt and everything. The challenge that most men have, right, generalization, is that their backsides fall out of their pants, you know? So wear a belt. Do you know what I mean? If you come to Jummah on Friday, right, or you ever come to pray when there's, huh?
No, I just said, where does that happen?
Where does it happen? Oh my God, man. I wish I could unsee the things that you see. Where does it happen? It happens every single place you can imagine. Right? And this is a challenge because religion tends to be a boys' club. You know? Most Muslim men are only identifiably understood to be Muslim because they walk next to a woman who's wearing a scarf on her head. There's hijab for men as much as there's hijab for women in Islam. And within this, like, again, how you choose to dress outside of prayer, like, is a different conversation. In the course of your prayer, you want to make sure that you're covered up the way that is meant to be covered. And within that, not think about it in terms of minimums. But what becomes challenging for many men is that when they bend over, like, their pants are rolling down and their backsides get exposed. And it happens a lot for people. So if you wear a belt, get a t-shirt, tuck it into your pants, right? This is why, like, culturally you see in many Muslim communities, Indian subcontinent, the Gulf, Indonesia, Malaysia, a lot of African countries, like, shirts go down past the waist for men, right? Because you don't have any idea, right? I'm wearing these black skinny jeans right now, you know, which probably somebody like me does not need to be wearing them. But I got a long shirt on. So when I pray, doesn't matter if something's rising up or down because it's covered, right? And in our culture, you see it embedded. If you go to Philly and you see African-American culture is very influenced and hip-hop culture is very influenced by Islam in terms of the way dress has kind of manifested in a lot of different ways. And it's adopted from these ideals, right? From, you know, how it is that you're covering yourself in these ways. So in the course of your prayer for men, just make sure, like, this is a big challenge for men. Like, you're not exposing, like, your backside in any way. Yeah, sorry.
Just making sure I can pray with, like, a short sleeve.
You can wear a t-shirt when you pray. Yeah.
And also, this is to you. Do you ever take your namaz hat off?
Me?
Yeah.
I do. I don't wear it 24 hours a day. Yeah.
I
wear it. I take it off. But for, you know, in my understanding, right, they say, like, the Prophet Muhammad was never without his head uncovered, other than when he would go on pilgrimage, he would be dressed in these two, like, white unstitched garments. And they said the companions of the Prophet were never without their head uncovered in prayer. You know, it was a sign of humility. It's not an obligation, though. Do you know what I mean? Right? But the bigger thing, right, if you're a man and you got one of these on, but your butt's falling out of your pants, like, that's screwing up your prayer. Do you get what I mean? So invest in a belt. Like, pull up your pants. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. And for women, it's the same concept. You're going to have everything covered other than the face, hands, and feet. And that's also kind of, despite what you're kind of dressed outside, it's a separate conversation. In the course of the prayer, like, you're covering the parts of the body also. And it's a precondition of the prayer, you know? And you want to think about it in terms of just, like, the event, the occasion. Do you know what I mean? Like, what is it that I'm really getting myself ready for here? And what is kind of the criteria, the dress code of the event? Okay, then fourth, the condition is you're facing towards the Kaaba, which is Mecca. So technology can help in a lot of different ways with this, but it also can be something that's pretty not so good.
we could probably have everybody open up a compass on their phone, and a majority of you would have a compass that kind of aligns properly, but some of you would also have them be just kind of all over the place, right? So this religion also has us very much deeply connected to things that are elemental, right? You make water with wudu. You know, our prayers are based off of a cyclical pattern of the sun. You can tell direction literally from like the place of the sun in the horizon. So where and how you can very easily, if you don't know where you are, you try your best. Like the sun is either, which is it? Is the sun rising or setting in the west? The sun rises then in the east, right? So it's going to be going on a cycle. So if you know the sun is coming up until noontime from one end, and it's going down post-noon till sunset the other way, then you know what east and west is, right? West is going to be there, and east is going to be there. So north is this way, so northeast is like this, which is why we're praying like this in the room, right? In the United States, the direction towards Mecca is northeast. And you could get to like specific degree marks. When you're not in front of the Kaaba in Mecca, there's a leeway of 45 degrees in either direction, right? You're just trying your best. So you don't have to be spot on every single time that you're going to do this. And you go to some masjids because of the leeway, and they're restricted by space constraints. They position slightly off the exact direction in order to have kind of the structure of the congregation be built out a little bit more feasibly. Do you know? In Manhattan, you know, an easy way is to just think you face uptown and you kind of angle to the right, right? Because streets are going south to north and avenues are going west to east. No, avenues are going south to north and streets are going west to east, right? And so that kind of helps. But you're facing towards the Kaaba, you're facing towards Mecca. And, you know, if you don't know how to figure it out, you ask somebody, right? If nobody knows, you just try your best. If you're in a place where you have constraints and you just have no way of doing it, you still pray the prayer in its time. Does that make sense? Yeah. So this is the next condition. You're facing towards Mecca. Five, the time of prayer has come in. So what that means is you are not able to pray a prayer before the time the prayer commences. Does it make sense? But there's windows of time. So the number of students I sit with at NYU, for example, who are first-year students, second-year students, and they are freaked out of their minds because they have to now adapt a new structure. Someone graduates and they go to work for the first time. Or people use language very irresponsibly, and they'll say, it's better to do X. That better doesn't mean obligatory. Do you get what I mean? So you have like an entire cyclical pattern of the sun. Say this is the horizon. So the first prayer of the day is called Fajr. And if we were to look at this from the standpoint of degree marks, there's a time where there's like the sun is approaching the horizon, right? And you should go watch the sunrise so you can think about this in this way. Do you know what I mean? And if you can't see the sunrise from where you are in the boroughs, go on a like trip. We'll take everybody upstate and we'll just watch the sunrise, you know? So as the sun is getting closer to the horizon, what are the first colors that you're seeing come above the horizon in a sunrise?
Red.
Red, right? So when you start to see redness above the horizon, like the time of Fajr is starting. Does that make sense? Right? Now, was it getting closer to the horizon? How does this sky start to change color?
Yellow.
And then what happens?
It
Like, what color is the sky right now? It's white, right? Yeah, so you're going from red, orange, yellow to white. That's the entire time of Fajr. Fajr stops when a portion of the sun is visible above the horizon. At that point in time, you cannot pray until the sun is completely above the horizon. So you have this whole window of time to pray Fajr. It doesn't have to be prayed right at the minute that it starts. You have an entire window of time to pray the Fajr prayer. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So when you look on an app and there's prayer times, it'll give you a time for Fajr starting and it'll give you the time for sunrise. You're praying in between that window. You then have the second prayer of the day is called Dhuhr. So when the sun is coming down from its zenith, this is when Dhuhr starts. So right before and after, when it's immediately above, like straight up, that's a time that you're also not supposed to pray. It's called the Zawal time. And just a few minutes before and a few minutes after. So today, like if Dhuhr starts at 1:02, you wouldn't pray at like 12:56, 12:50-ish. Or sorry, that's too much time. You wouldn't pray at like 12:57 or so, give or take, right? You start to pray after the time comes. And some people make this mistake. If you come to Jummah on Friday, right, the time for Dhuhr is the time that Jummah starts. People walk in, they just start praying in that time that you're not supposed to be praying. This goes until the time of Asr, which is, in the Hanafi school, there's two opinions. There's the twice the length of your shadow or one time the length of your shadow. Most people pray at one time the length of your shadow. It's an earlier time. And twice the length is a little later in the afternoon. Then you have from Dhuhr till the time your shadow is twice its length to pray Dhuhr, right? So today that would be from 1 o'clock in the afternoon until almost 5 o'clock if you do the earlier time, until after 6 o'clock if you do the later time, right? And you can see where somebody would get stressed out if they thought I could only play it right at the very first minute. Do you get what I'm saying? This is where better is like an arbitrary term, you know? Because people have a lot of different things going on. So you just pray it within the window of time that it has to be prayed. And then the fourth prayer of the day, so this is where we have Asr, here's Dhuhr, and then you have sunset, is the Maghrib time, that goes until the time of Isha, which is night, and you have these windows, again, to pray these times. So the time of the prayer has to come in for the prayer's validity, its performance, right? So you can't pray Dhuhr over here, because it's not Dhuhr time yet. It's got to be after the time has come in. Does that make sense? Yeah? Yeah, go ahead.
I read something online that it said like Zuhr and Asr could be prayed together and then Maghrib and Isha, like if conditions, like if you can't make that at a certain time, you can combine them.
You can combine the prayers if you're traveling. There are some opinions that say if there's like immense hardship, then you can combine prayers also. But the hardship has to be something that is kind of ascertained in conjunction with like advice from somebody who's a religious scholar. Do you know? Yeah. But those are things that are there. Like I was in Canada and there's parts of Canada, for example, where like Maghrib comes in at 11 something and Isha is at like midnight and Fajr's at 2 a.m, you know? And there's like times of the year where it's just perpetual sunlight or perpetual darkness in some parts of the world. People have to kind of adapt, you know what I mean? And so they have religious scholars there who say because of like people's work schedules and need for sleep and whatever else, that they'll pray Isha and Maghrib together just for those 2 months in the summer where that time is constrained, right? But they're like coming together on a consensus with it, you know? So there is room for these kinds of things.
But individually, you'd want to talk to somebody who kind of knows, you know? Yeah, you had your hand raised.
Well, what's Qiyam?
Qiyam? Qiyam is, like, in its literal sense, it means just standing. And what people refer to is like like an optional night prayer where you stand. Like it's like an extra prayer. Okay. It just means like praying extra stuff at night. Okay. Yeah. then you have what's called the intention. And the intention is what distinguishes the prayer you're about to perform. So you're making the intention for the prayer, right? So we'll talk about these more in detail next week. But for example, in the Fajr prayer, you have two cycles of recommended prayer, sunnah prayers, and two cycles of obligatory, fard prayers. The only difference in the performance of those prayers is the intention. In one cycle, you're going to say, I intend to pray 2 units of recommended prayer for Fajr and finishing the intention, right? For your sake, facing Mecca, make it easy for me and accept it from me. Intention can be done in English. It doesn't have to be done in Arabic. And it's expressed, the place of intention is on the tongue and in the heart, right? We want to start bringing presence. And all of it still, like you can see a thread of just consciousness going through this, right? Making sure I'm washed up, there's nothing dirty on me, I'm dressed properly, I'm facing towards Mecca, the time is there, and now I'm affirming why I'm going to do what I'm going to do before I do it. And that intention is not considered a part of the prayer, it is prior to, it's outside of the prayer. And then you have the last component, which is called tahrima, and it's going to be on this list, and next week when we talk about the obligatory acts of prayer, which will be a much quicker conversation, it'll be also the first one on that, because some people consider it to be a condition for the validity of the prayers commencing, and some people consider it to be a obligatory act of the prayer. But in both instances, it's an obligation. This is an opening invocation, you know, where you're saying like the, you'll see people when they pray, they'll do like the initial Allahu Akbar, right? That's the tahrima. It has the word, like the letters for haram in it, right? Which, what did we say the word haram means? Strictly prohibited, right? So what's happening when you do this tahrima is you're now making things that are permissible impermissible. So you're entering into the prayer with this, and you're basically saying, hey, in general, it's okay for me to talk on my phone, but in my prayer, it's not permissible for me to talk on my phone. In my prayer, I'm facing only towards Mecca. I'm not moving around, right? In my prayer, I'm not talking to anybody next to me. I'm only talking to God. So embedded in the word is the idea that you're rendering certain things now that you could normally do, you won't do them in the course of the prayer. And all of these are things that are happening before you start the prayer. These are conditions, shurut, of the prayer itself. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So let's take a pause here. What you want to do is work on Fatiha between this week and next week. It's memorization. And what we want to also do is, if you have any questions on wudu, bring them for next week, whether you were here when we reviewed it in detail like some months ago or not. And if you haven't already, try to build a relationship with the timings of the prayer. Just like the windows of time. Acquaint yourself with them, right? This is a really important part of the prayer. It's called Hurm al-Waqt, the sanctity of time, right? And there's a understanding spiritually, the same way we talked about focus, khushu'. In Islam, the way that we worship is outlined through direct understanding from God and God's messenger. So
I couldn't tell you why these are the best times to pray these prayers, but they're fundamentally the best time to pray them because this is when God said to pray the prayers. And if you're doing them outside of those timings, then you're cutting yourself off from the blessing of those timings, and the transformational nature of the prayer kind of gets left out, right? So it also shouldn't take a while to do the prayer as such in that initial stage that we've talked about, the obligations, which doesn't have you go through every single step of it, but you want to be ready for it. Do you know what I mean? You start to think, right, between this week and next week, what are things that come up for you that make it hard? Do you know? That we can talk out here like we did, you know, some months ago. Like, how can you anticipate being in a state of wudu? It doesn't mean you have to make wudu every time you pray. If there's nothing that broke your wudu, then you could have wudu the whole entire day if you needed to, right? And you start to think from the standpoint of, like, this spiritual exercise is nourishment for my inner self, the way food is nourishment for my physical self. Let me not think about these two things separate from each other, but how does my physical and metaphysical relate to one another? You know? So if I know it's hard for me to make wudu at work, then maybe what I eat at breakfast isn't something that's going to have me breaking my wudu like when I'm in the office. Do you know? I can time like my meals. I'm a little bit more strategic in my routine. Do you get what I mean? Right? But you're putting like an idea that in Islam, what you get out of something is heavily connected to like what you're putting into it, you know? And you can see what something's a priority based off of your kind of overall engagement in that capacity. So think about it and try to build a relationship with the time and come with like scenarios, questions, and then we'll start going through the obligatory acts and the necessary acts and look at two short chapters of the Quran. Also, we'll break it down the way we broke down Fatiha and start to go through some of the meanings of the other words that we're saying in the different positions, right? Like, what do the words mean when we're in the bowing position? You know, what does the words mean when we're in the prostrating positions? Does that make sense? Okay. Oh, and if you can come on Friday, it's Fried Chicken Friday after Juma. So come and have lunch with us too. But otherwise, we'll see everyone next week. Assalamu alaikum.